And welcome back to another episode of my podcast. It's called In a Perfect World, and it is a perfect world despite appearances. We are here in this sacred gift of life, and we have one shot at it that we remember each time. And I'm very glad to have my guest today is Arishta Dean, who is... Well, you're many things. I've got you down here as one of the founders of the Sacred Foundation, which is a group of dedicated clergy and healthcare professionals with extensive entheogenic training and experience, according to your website. And you've written about and presented, and most recently we met again at Martin Ball's Exploring Psychedelics conference in Ashland in May, which is always a great... almost sort of like community level event for many different people in the entheogenic, shamanic and consciousness community, sort of beyond the traditional academic sort of speakers, but to find the people who are really doing cutting edge stuff and are really walking their talk. So welcome, Arishta. I'm pleased to have you here today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So let's see, I started out fairly light in life on this medicine path. In my about 50 years old. So this was about 15 years ago. And actually got involved with a mystery school that later led me to the medicine path. So I came in through a very spiritual gateway into the entheogenic world, and I think that was important for me as an analytical type. I was a manager and engineer in Silicon Valley, and so approached the entheogenic path through both a spiritual perspective and my own passion is from the historical aspect as well. So early on, I was introduced to the tradition of the blue lotus flower from Egypt and the historical perspective of what was going on with that. So I became quite the champion of that medicine line, and my forthcoming book is all about the blue lotus and how that really shaped our spiritual traditions in Egypt and Greece and even into Rome. So that's my passion. I got involved with Martin's entheogenic, his Exploring Psychedelic conference here 3 years ago. I've spoken at each conference since then. Love the venue, love the people involved. You may say that the speakers are not academic, but I find them much more academic than the standard group, or a little bit more, academic than the average group, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate that we are all definitely explorers
we are indeed.
And so, pioneers out there.
So tell me, Arishta, I'm always interested in finding out how people come to this, because there's what's being called at the moment a psychedelic renaissance happening, I guess, in Western culture. And I think that term really is like a platform for the medicalization of psychedelics and coming back into established traditions and getting all the mainstream press, you know, Michael Pollan's book and all the big sort of articles on MDMA and PTSD and LSD use for that and psilocybin for these clinical uses. But there's also this, you know, entheogenic explosion and this sort of shamanic resurgence of personal healing, of people that are connecting with their own spirituality and the web of life and what it means to be reconnected to the planet through the gateway and the gift of entheogenic plants. And as you say, you've come from a Silicon Valley background. So how does one make that transition? Being discreet about things you may have to be discreet about.
Certainly, my introduction to entheogens and psychedelic experience really opened that doorway for me, and I was already semi-retired at the time, and so it wasn't a giant leap to go from one to the other. I was very interested scientifically of what was going on. So as I gauged the experience, both my experience and the experience that was going on around me, one of the things I spoke about this year at Exploring Psychedelics was that I found it fascinating that there was shared experience within the medicine field, meaning that we could go to a ayahuasca ceremony or other group ceremony, and we as individuals, by all rights and science, should be having unique, individualized experiences that don't overlap. But in fact, there's this tremendous overlap of experience where we are sharing a similar experience or seeing similar things. And that's what really got my attention in a big way. And I can say it really changed my life.
Beautiful. So it seems that in one sense, coming from a more corporate sort of background into this entheogenic community, you've been forming structures. And you mentioned the key term like a mystery school before, and that's something which really interests me as well. I sort of see this evolution in the Western shamanic approach or entheogenic approach that the containers we create to do the work are starting to evolve beyond just the peak experience of one night or one retreat into a more structured setting, which is really about the integration of the experience, the depth exploration of these spaces that are opened up, and as you say, what we can do consensually together, like what are we experiencing collectively? How does that connect us as a group or a tribe, and what do we do with that?
Exactly. So, in my own quest to answer that, then I began diving into history and got into the Greek use of entheogens, and then moved that exploration into both Egypt and Rome. So there's a lot of evidence to indicate that there was both systematic and structured use of entheogens in the ancient world to provide a mystical experience for the priesthood. Now, mind you, most of this history was very exclusive just to the priesthoods of the ancient world. But there's a lot of evidence to indicate that they were developing a structured ritualistic approach to be able to induce a mystical experience. To literally to speak to the gods, if not become as the gods, as the word entheogen kind of implies. So that really got my attention, and that's the piece that I am working towards, both as a minister and as an executive director of this nonprofit.
So you're the co-founder also of the priesthood of Nefertum, is that?
Nefertem, about 2010, a group of us began working with the sacred blue lotus, the water lily of the Nile. It's a rare and endangered flower. It's going extinct. It's almost extinct on the Nile. There's a few places in Thailand that are growing blue lotus. But I became very interested in this, and we began to realize that this had an entheogenic property. have later come to understand that it is more of a catalyst. It's more of a primer to the experience than something that produces an entheogenic experience itself.
Well, maybe let's just step back. I mean, there's so much in modern entheogenic culture, like the big hitters like ayahuasca, psilocybin, 5-MeO, DMT, San Pedro. They pretty much get all the reportage and the awareness. But I mean, when we start talking about Egypt, and this is the interesting thing, from these cults or these mystery schools or these lineages which had entheogenic sacraments, and you mentioned Greece, and reportedly, Greece had the mysteries of Eleusis, which had the Kaiakion, or probably mispronouncing that, but a sacrament which every man, woman, child, and slave took at least once for initiation into the great mystery. But the mystery schools pierced the mystery with their usages of these interfaces. And the Sacred Blue Lotus is one that is pretty much overlooked. I mean, it's not that well known. So could you tell us just a bit more about that and give context to it?
Yeah, because it in itself doesn't do a whole lot. I mean, you can consume all the blue lotus you want, and you might say, well, it kind of, sort of is doing something. It's alcohol soluble, so it needs to be made into a solution or fermented. So what we began to do is we actually first began making wine. Now we're making mead. But the alkaloids are alcohol soluble. But in itself is rather mild and benign, and like it's not going to slam you over your head like ayahuasca or DMT. This is something very, very subtle. So it never received a whole lot of attention. It was just one of those curiosities until we began to experiment with combining it with other entheogens, and then the doorway opened.
How did you first think about that? I mean, you thought that...
It was actually rather accidental. Just here a couple years ago, I was in ceremony myself, and I literally had the opportunity for the first time to say, oh, I'm going to use them together. And then I went into, this warp drive type of experience of going, whoa, what just happened? It was very different than my normal in this case, it was psilocybin experience. It was something very different. So then I went on this quest of trying to get validation. I started contacting any and everybody that I could think of to say, hey, please come try this. Let's see where this is going. And everybody to every single person that has experienced this ceremony has now said, oh, this is very different from mushrooms as they've experienced it before. So I began to realize that we were onto something. And so that's where I went to Egypt, did the research, my first trip to Egypt. And then I went to Greece a few years later and spent 3 months in Greece doing research there about how both the Eleusinian mysteries and the mystery traditions of Greece were overlapping with the information that the Greeks were getting from the Egyptians.
So I'm looking at one of your websites, thesacredbluelotus.com, and you describe the effects of the Blue Lotus Sacrament as a pleasant feeling of warmth around the head and upper body, a comfortable dreamy feeling with a slight stimulant effect. The flower seems to produce a subtle, high-level, expanded state of consciousness, but not much beyond that on its own. So when you're saying it's used, is it sort of like a precursor or an MAO inhibitor or a synergizer when it's worked with psilocybin?
I would say it's a synergizer. It's definitely not an MAO type of experience. Here's the interesting thing is that there's been some academic research on the water lilies in general, And they seem to contain two different chemicals, alkaloids. One's something called neusephrine, and then the other one is a porphine. The most research that I've seen has been on a porphine, and it's a very interesting chemical that binds with our DNA in the same neural receptors that are being stimulated by our DMT chemicals, literally all of the alkaloids that are psychotropic.
Is it the 5-HT2A?
Two, exactly. And a porphine gets in there and binds with the DNA molecule and elongates it. So it slides in between the gaps in the DNA molecule and literally changes the shape. And that structural shape change seems to be rather persistent and long-lasting. We don't know exactly how long, but probably in the terms of months. So as the in the case of psilocybin coming up through that neural receptor, then if the neural receptor itself is of a different shape, then the response of that is going to be different. And so there's this unique catalytic effect of the Blue Lotus. There seems to be some indication that Blue Lotus was used with something called mandrake, and we're all familiar with mandrake root from the Middle Ages, but the Egyptians were using the actual fruit itself. So it was a little safer in the way that it wasn't going to kill people, but they were using a mandrake, blue lotus, poppy, and mushrooms together. We've come across some historical reliefs on the walls of at Abydos that indicate that this was their formula.
If the blue lotus is binding to the same receptor sites, I mean, you say you used it with psilocybin and it catalyzes that medicine. Have you experimented with other medicines that work on the same receptor? Well, does it work with other things as well?
We did some preliminary trials with ayahuasca, and it wasn't giving us the same results. So I am not sure about the full range. We have not gotten that far. Our trials up until now have been pretty much standardized with just the psilocybin to make sure that what we were seeing across the board was true for anybody coming into the field.
And how would you describe the internal feeling of the synergy with the Blue Lotus and the psilocybin?
It's very emotional. It's more emotional, and takes the subject to a deeper level. The other interesting thing is that where psilocybin is known for its big bright visuals, lots of geometrics, lots of patterns, all of that goes away with Blue Lotus. You don't get a whole lot of visuals aspect on it, but you get a visceral feeling that you're participating in something deeper. So again, we're still exploring this to see where it's all going.
So, what is the historical evidence? Or you say on the Sacred Blue Lotus website that the Blue Lotus sacrament was used for over 3,000 years, medicinally and spiritually, by the priesthoods of ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome. And it was so important that the Egyptians declared a god, Neferetim, to protect and care for it. It's interesting, isn't it? So, what was happening back there?
There's never been another civilization that deified a flower. The Egyptians were the first and only ones. Now, certainly there have been deities to nature in general or a particular forest or something like that, but this was the first and only time that a deity was dedicated, not only dedicated to a flower, but they actually believed that the god Nefertim was the flower. So in taking the flower into you, then by definition you were taking this god into you. And in that union, then there was this elevation of to the point of being able to communicate, to commune with the gods, to induce this mystical experience.
Interesting. So, what evidence do we have of the use in ancient Egypt?
The probably the first and foremost thing is that in a lot of the wall art, paintings, carvings, and things on the tombs and temples, you will see blue lotus flowers draped over jars in the offerings to the gods and to the pharaohs. And so it really led me particularly to say, all right, if I wanted to show you what was in a jar on a pictograph, then perhaps I would have that image of that object on top of the jar. So if I wanted to say, to show you that there was wine in a jar, it would be logical to have grapes hung on that jar. So that you go, oh, okay, there's grapes in that jar. Well, what if you see this blue lotus flower hanging on the jar? And so this was the first indicator for me that it was the question, that this ultimate question of what's in the jar. So this representation is ubiquitous. It's everywhere in Egypt of these blue lotus flowers being presented and draped over jars. So that was my first indicator that I was on to something. And then there are representations of blue lotus combined again with other substances. Most frequently in the early kingdom was blue lotus and mandrake fruit. They even had a special hieroglyphic for the union of the blue lotus and the mandrake. And there is no question at all that mandrake, because it is nightshade, it's poisonous, you're not going to be taking it, you're not going to be eating it for a meal. So putting two known entheogens together in a representation is pretty darn clear that somebody knew the psychotropic properties of this combination. So that goes back 5,000 years ago.
Wow, yeah. And so on its own, it's not that powerful, let's say, but
Yeah,
with the
that's the
mandrake.
thing that's kept it safe, and both safe from being scheduled and ignored and making it almost extinct, is that by itself it just doesn't do anything.
Is there any evidence or thinking? I mean, you're saying it was probably used with mandrake in ancient Egypt, and did they have any other entheogens? I mean, it's the desert, it's a certain
Well, you
climate.
gotta remember back then it wasn't a desert. It was grasslands up until, oh, probably 2000 BC. But certainly, the Egyptians knew about poppies and they knew about mushrooms. And so it's pretty logical to guess that, over a period of thousands of years, they would have tried them together and come up with the best combination of those plants and substances to produce this mystical experience.
Was there any ritual or what was the container you think they used in those ceremonies?
We don't get any images of that until really into the Roman times. The cult of Isis, or at her, that her name is actually Isis. So I make that definition between Isis, a terrorist organization, and Isis, a goddess. Isis in the Roman times was after the death of Cleopatra was the most popular goddess. In fact, the most popular religion before Christianity, and it just kind of exploded into the Roman Empire. There was over 400 temples and chapels to the goddess Isis, and my contention in my book is that this was an entheogenic religion. For the first time, the pouring of the medicine actually went to the participants, much like the Eleusinian mysteries, versus just being restricted to the priesthood. So since they were pouring medicine for the general population, of course it became very popular.
Interesting. So, you know, what I'm interested in as well is this interplay between these ancient civilizations. Like, I guess as geopolitically one conquers another, or the rise and fall of one civilization, but the trading then of medicines and of lineages and of that connection between Egypt and Rome and Greece, it seems like that the mystery school traditions continued.
Oh, absolutely. And that started with the Greeks. The first Greek colonies down in Egypt were about 500 BC. And so this is really in what's called the archaic period of the Greek civilization. The thing that we have to remember is that Egypt was already in ruins. I mean, the height of the Egyptian Empire was, you know, about 1200 BC. There's some evidence that the whole civilization collapsed around 1100 BC. And after that, it was just nothing was really going on in Egypt. It was overtaken by various different other peoples. And finally, the Greeks got down in there about 500 BC. My point is that when I went over to Greece and I got there in Athens and started my hunt for find some evidence of Blue Lotus, I went to the museum. I walked in and turned left two doorways, and there was a full-size statue of a priestess completely ordained or outfitted in Blue Lotus. She had a crown of alternating blue lotus flowers opened and closed, and she was holding a blue lotus bud in her hand. And it was shocking to me because here was this Greek priestess in a statue that was found outside of Athens, and she's holding blue lotus. And of course, blue lotus doesn't grow in Greece. It only grew in Egypt. So it is real big proof that there is this, like you said, this interplay, this interconnection of the civilizations sharing entheogenic knowledge.
So I really like this mystery school meme, this idea. And, you know, the ancient mystery schools might have died and we've got some historical evidence of them, but there seems to be this resurgence. Like, you call yourself a priestess of Isis or Isis, don't you? And it's like there's this reclamation in the modern times of this ancient wisdom, isn't there?
There is. And regardless of how you perceive God, goddess, the divine source, we all pretty much can agree that our entheogenic traditions lead us to this divine connection, that they are leading us to this mystical experience, this oneness, this non-duality that occurs at this peak experience in the medicine field, regardless of how you, whatever the substance or the methodology that you're taking. That's the objective, is that the mystical experience has been this driving, motivating force that has been at the core of all religions down through the ages. And I think that to me, I think that our entheogenic revolution, that the this renaissance that people are talking about, at its core, again, we're all heading towards that we're ultimately speaking of the mystical experience, is this connection with the universe. And it is quite the different objective of an entheogenic experience versus just getting high and wanting to go and enjoy a concert, while stoned. Seeking a mystical experience is something entirely different.
It is. And I guess maybe in 21st century Western culture, we still have this cult of individuality. And even though we're seeming to, in global culture now, so interconnected, and everyone's sort of clustering into sort of digital tribes, and there's memes go around, and Facebook likes get 70 million views for baby photos and things. There's this potential for group cohesion coming together. And I wonder if in the entheogenic community, you think that we've gone through this period of sort of solo adventuring into the mystery and individual sort of experiences. But do you feel we're coming around to a time when things like the structure of mystery schools or the structure of group work is becoming more pronounced?
I don't know. That's a tough call because, like you said, the fierce individualism. Probably even more so from what I've seen in the entheogenic community is that I'm very interested in reclaiming or trying to reestablish group participation. But right now, I think that we're still at that place of individual exploration. So I don't know. Ask me in 10 years and we'll see how this all goes.
Well, let's frame it another way, because you basically have formed a modern day mystery school with your organization, with the
Certainly trying.
yeah. So then you must believe that there's a place for a container
I
like a
do.
mystery school.
I
Tell us
do.
about what your hopes are for that then.
I know how it benefited me, and so I certainly want to be able to share that with other people. So, and the way to do that is to be able to talk about both ceremony and container theory, and with that all the quantum physics that are involved in creating this structure to be able to hold the focus,
Yeah.
you
So
know, our conscious focus.
that was your focus for the Exploring Psychedelics talk. Maybe talk a little bit about this idea of beyond set and setting and the container and.
So I was fascinated with this concept of shared experience, that I could see something in a group medicine experience. I could, my quote, hallucination, I found out very quickly, may not be internal just to me. My first ayahuasca ceremony, I was able to have an experience and see this big white moth butterfly thing kind of float through the ceremony, and I thought at the time that that was an hallucination, but then later the next day I found out that many people had seen that, and yet this was it could not have been something in the 3D. This was definitely something that happened in our ceremony, but more than one person saw it. So then, as as my scientific mind said, all right, what the hell is going on? It was like, how can we be sharing a quote hallucination? And so over the years, I've found out that there is this whole field of quantum physics studies that that talks about that our perceptions of reality create reality, and that when we're in the medicine field, well, we're no longer thinking on three-dimensional terms, you know, as that we talk about being in five-dimensional space, that in that quantum realm, that the very real possibility is that we're seeing another dimension, that we're not limited to just our three-dimensional perceptions, is that the chemical experience in our brain are chemically enhanced to be able to see more dimensional aspects, and that there's a very real possibility that we're seeing interdimensional space.
I agree. You know what's really interesting as well? There's still yet to be done research on. We know that essentially through EEG and MRI studies that they've done this with ayahuasca, psilocybin, and LSD, that it's lowering the default mode network and those regional clusters of the brain, which are keeping us in individual egoic consciousness. When we lower those barriers and we're going into the spectrum of expanded consciousness, which is always there, it seems to me that it's an independent or interconnected geography of inner space, and that we need to do more exploration of that to see if what we're seeing, other people are seeing, it's potentially very doable as an exercise in group mapping of the terra incognita.
It is. You know, and one of the classic examples of this is the classic DMT or 5-MeO experience of seeing and hearing, experiencing other entities, of that it's a very common experience to see these other entities, and it feels like that they're trying to make contact with us in that field. I think that it's time for us to begin to explore this as a group, and stop thinking about this just being hallucinations.
Well, let's clarify that the perception of entities and other potential beings, whether they're representations of something within us or something within an energetic ecology on the astral, is traditionally associated with NNDMT, not necessarily 5-MeO, which is more non-dual. But speaking of, which is one of my favorite subjects, I have been doing my own experimentations in countries like Mexico, where this is legal, with group works on retreats and things like that. And, you know, we've experimented. I mean, when we talk about psilocybin and blue lotus and the traditional entheogens, when the default mode network goes down and we launch into the expanded ecology, which is dimensionally around us to begin with, we go exploring. When we're on 5-MeO DMT as well, there's something so much more that's possible, I think, because essentially the ego can fully flatline and reduce. And then it really makes me wonder when it reveals that potential unified field or source within, it's like that ocean of originating consciousness, but it's in everyone and in everything. And if the individual's barrier to that goes down in a group, then the whole group are like petals on a single flower as source consciousness blossoms. And then it really creates these synergies and potentials for hive mind and for creating almost a circuit through the individual entity, people, the units, for that consciousness to both inhabit and to explore. And I wonder how much of the ancient world where, I mean, we mentioned the mysteries of Eleusis and the rites they did there, From what I've heard, they did big group rituals where people would be all together in a room or a special container, a ceremony space, doing the ritual and inhaling the fumes or something like that. But they're potentially, it's something that, they have been doing group work of this type before.
The Eleusinian Mysteries are the most famous because the temple was dedicated to this annual medicine experience with up to 4,000 people all in one room.
Wow,
Just an
mega trip.
extraordinary, nothing like this in any other culture, any other time. Of so many people all involved in the same thing. And yes, there was certainly some pageantry and stage work involved, but then also that everybody was all dialed into the same frequency with the medicine experience.
I wonder, is there any evidence of, like not just how that started, but did it start with individuals who then brought it to the group? Because when we talk about this, we talk about Egypt, we talk about Rome, we talk about Greece. These are some of the fundamental civilizations which helped birth Western culture through the learnings and the intelligence and what they've handed down, but also that entheogenic knowledge which may have contributed to their, receiving their own wisdoms which form their civilizations. It's like we've inherited that as well, haven't we?
We have, and it's, I think it's been staring us right in the face of all of these, certainly for the last 1600 years, that since the monotheism came in and took over. But the evidence is really quite right in front of us. When
So,
you ask about whether or not it's single individuals, probably yes, they did say, "Wow, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I need to share it." And then over, years and centuries and millennia, the Eleusinian Mysteries in particular, which have this known history of almost 2,000 years of continuous use and continuous ceremonies, really quite extraordinary.
but also the takeaway from that is something which shouldn't be glossed over, because we're talking about these responsible cultures which, Greeks birthing democracy and things like that. But I mean, these fundamental cultural catalysts who used the entheogenic experience, who believed in it so much that they, like many people who have had entheogenic experiences, want to share it with their friends and family and want to say to them, "Oh my God, there's this whole other world out there that we've been blocked from and it's been censored, but it's available." It's like, one toke away, I think Terence McKenna used to say. But the idea is these democratic civilizations believed in the entheogenic principle so much, they brought it to all their citizens.
Correct.
That's very powerful.
It's extremely powerful. And of course, to those in power, those who want to take that away from the individuals of a civilization, you can see how that has been then turned to a power play to censor and to keep us from having these experiences.
But in the inverse, it's funny because for 2,000 years, if they had this ritual in the Greek traditions, they maintained civilization. It didn't collapse. They didn't all just lie around and become drug
Just the
addled and
opposite, huh?
just got. But it must have main, yeah, it must have maintained some sense of cohesion, of identity. And then what I heard, about the Eleusinian Mysteries is it was that initiation into knowing who and what you
That's
really
right.
are. And because of that, then you could plug into your culture, your community, and it didn't necessarily change the status quo of slaves and other people, or other things, but in some levels it maintained this cohesion of people accepting their life in the game of life because they knew there was something bigger. And it must have still even trickled down in some of the senses of the isms they brought to their culture.
Absolutely. And one of the things we do have to remember is that in in the ancient world, these initiations were a one-shot thing. As like, so we didn't get an opportunity to go back to Eleusis and to go have medicine every weekend. This was not a once-a-month thing. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to experience these things. So your initiation was a very, very big deal. And in fact, it would take virtually 9 months of your life to prepare for this. You would start preparing at the beginning of the year, and finally by September, they would have the ceremony. So it was an extraordinary big life event for the Greeks.
How can something that big and monumental be sort of buried in the historical footnotes?
I don't know how to answer that without, I certainly don't want to tread on other people's religions. However, from a historical perspective, there were certainly a mass concerted effort to destroy all the ancient knowledge after the fall of Rome.
It's all the power plays, isn't it? And which is the ego
Exactly
controlling.
right. Exactly right.
So what do we think then? There's these civilizations which have had this entheogenic sacrament. They lasted for, thousands of years in the Greek case. There was that relationship with the divine within. What can we learn from that, applying that to modern entheogenic culture?
That's a great question. I love this whole train of thought because I believe that civilization is in the midst of a new birthing. That the entheogenic aspect is just the indicator of how we as human beings, as the human species, are on the verge of something revolutionary. Not so much we've experienced it before as a people, but now coming out of a repressive time of history, I believe that we're now again this Renaissance goes even way beyond anything that we can imagine. Is that we're truly beginning to change our idea of who and what we are as a species, as individuals.
And so this is what I'm interested in. It's like we've got, shamanic culture and psychedelic culture, and we describe the individualism. And it seems to me, if it's going to continue to grow, you also describe the difference between the one-off initiations of the ancient cultures, and there's now, it's I guess in some ways you could say it's almost in danger of being commodified. Things like ayahuasca as a lifestyle fad, or but for the people who are engaging with it, it's an ongoing participation of the great mystery. But there seems to be, an integration of it into people's lives, of wanting to connect to themselves, to go for healing. But once they're either healed, it's like, what is the value of these medicines beyond the healing modality in that reconnection sort of stream?
And that's an excellent point. Is like, okay, so what do we do with this? We have these experiences. We connect with the divine, and you can see this, feel this, experience this other world. But then, how does that relate to our three-dimensional world? And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of connection. There's not a lot we can bring back and say, well, we're gonna change things in the three-dimensional plane. We're looking at a world that's going the opposite direction that we are as this entheogenic community. So there's almost this like the separation of the herd. Very, very concerning is that something is happening to us as a species. I believe that we're evolving. That the medicines themselves are changing our consciousness, our brain structure, and so yeah, there is this tendency for us to say, wow, I want to keep going to this. I want this once a month or every few months. I want these experiences to continue and not just as a one shot initiation.
And you know what I think with many things, I mean, my work with 5-MeO, it's different again in some ways, but it's like there seems to be that tangible presence. It's something that we connect to that's within us. But in that connection, it's almost as if our temple hard drives get formatted to hold that information. And then there's a living relationship we can explore endogenously with that source consciousness within. And I wonder what you think of that.
I completely agree. I think that is the fundamental shift that's happening is that these what we normally we're calling inner realms, but this interdimensional space, this place that we're going to, that we're continuing to go back and explore and go deeper and deeper into that. It's not just a handful of us exploring it the way it was in the 60s. Now we have tens, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, perhaps millions of people now exploring these realms. And this is a fundamental shift in consciousness in humanity.
Yeah, and it seems to me maybe there's a critical mass which is reach, you know, where it's not just that we agree that there is a consensual other reality, like a larger energetic ecology and astral dimension, and there's these things, but it's a space, and perhaps it is inhabited, and perhaps cultures like Egypt and Greece who had these experiences, perhaps the gods and perhaps entities and perhaps beings aren't separate or aren't just fictional, but they're maybe by going into these spaces, we're establishing protocols of engagement with those spaces and the beings which live in them, which can change not just our perception of reality here, but our reality of reality here.
Exactly. I couldn't say it better.
Go on, try. You're the priestess of Isis. Come on.
It's the realm of the gods. You know, the very definition of a mystical experience is that you're communing with the divine. You're non-duality. You are God. You are the universe. You have stepped into that realm. When we began to accept the responsibility of being at least, let's just say, child of God, first of all, there's a sense of responsibility for us when we're exploring these realms, is that we want to be able to, most of us want to be able to share this experience with people to say, wait, you know, what you think is real, there's much more to reality than what you think. And when you talk about, the strength of the numbers, the sheer number of people that are sharing these experiences, and we're able to communicate and know what we're talking to each other about, that they're, it's not just abstract light shows in our heads, is that there is a quantifiable, definite experience that we can talk about and share what we're seeing, what we're feeling, and how that affects our lives.
And you know, the whole Egyptian mystique is built around like these pyramids. We still don't know exactly what they were for. There's pyramids all over the planet. They're all connected on ley lines pointing up at star systems. And the Egyptians believed, you know, these gods descended from the star systems and they used entheogens. There seems to be like this whole bigger reality which we've been disconnected from, with entheogens helping that reconnection too.
Absolutely. So where this is all headed, I have no idea. You know, here we are in the 21st century. All of us were raised thinking that we were going to go off in Star Trek and explore the galaxy, and here we're still stuck on the planet. But this has opened up. This Stargate has opened up for us, and this is showing us a whole another dimension, a whole nother universe that's right here. It's not inside of our heads. It is simply a layer that's on top of this dimension.
It's like we're the stargates, and it's opening up to all the other points in space-time that are out there that
Yeah.
are alive and intelligent and welcoming us home.
That's right.
So that's the big picture then. Now, looking at your sacred foundation, you say your mission statement is to reestablish the ethical and sacred use of altered states and to advocate for their legal psycho-spiritual use. So how is that going, anchoring that big mission and the big vision in the everyday politics of the mundane world?
Yeah, slow. It's going real slow right now. It is this observation for me is that that religion, this desire to communicate with a creator, a god or goddess that we feel connected to, and then fill in the blank of what that name is or who that is. It really doesn't matter. It's just our own personification of something much larger. But with entheogens, you get a visceral, real-time, direct feedback, absolute connection that is unmistakable. I want to be able to reintroduce that into the spiritual community. I want to be able to say, you know, what you've been told about psychotropics is not true, and I've got the proof here to indicate that that for 10,000 years these substances were used within the spiritual religious community, and it can only benefit your spiritual connection. It can only enhance your ability to commune with how you perceive God, goddess. It should be, you know, it's a terrible disservice to humanity to take away these substances from our spiritual and religious ceremonies. And my objective is to try to reintroduce these. You know, now that we have legal cannabis, just in particular, seems to me that if a congregation wanted to be in touch with God, they should all light up in the pews. I mean, especially for the states where it's absolutely legal, is like, yes, give the parishioner a direct experience with the divine.
Well, you
And
know, cannabis is in the Bible with a K, cannabis. It was one of the oil, the anointing oil for
it's the anointing
the
oil, yeah.
Messiah, the anointed one,
Yeah.
having a full somatic cannabis, you know, if, excursion into the inner realms
And
from
that's
that
just the
thing.
tip of the iceberg.
It is, and so, you know, they did studies in the 60s and again in the last decade or so with the Good Friday experiment with religious scholars being given psilocybin, and again they posited that, you know, it was this mystical experience which affirmed their religion and affirmed their spirituality and one of the top experiences of their lives. And what you're saying makes me realize as well is that, yeah, I wonder how much of the establishment power structures like religion and like the priesthood, let's say, in states and countries where these substances are now legal, why aren't they? And where are the outreaches to educate them and to look at the few scientific studies that have been done for the mystical experience? Just recently, I know my colleague Joseph Barsuglia was one of the people involved in graphing information on the 5-MeO state, and you know, it's more powerful as a mystical catalyst than the psilocybin itself. But these substances are being studied for their mystical, catalyzing potential. And if the church really wanted to re-energize and re-engage with, modern audiences and to reclaim its power and its service in that power, I mean, the thing is, we're talking about people that have these experiences outside of structure and the individualism that's all good and well, but then to have a trained professional whose role it is to, represent and being in service to God, to give you that structure, priests and priestesses are the ones who should be claiming that role in these times, aren't they?
Absolutely. But that has been removed from our, that chapter of history has just been ripped out and hidden from us. So going forward, my belief is that this time in our culture, in our history, is ripe for the resurgence of an entheogenic priesthood, of people who are not are not controlled by any one church or theology, is that it is truly an opportunity for something new to come in. I'm of the feeling that religion is a cultural explanation of the unknown. It is a cultural explanation of our origins, of how the universe works, and all of the structure and the rules, let's put rules in quotes, that operate in the universe. But those things change. You can't say that the values and the constructs that were built 1700 years ago are still valid in the 21st century. We need new eyes, we need new structure, we need a new priesthood.
We need a new religion, huh?
We need a new religion.
And it's the old, it's the same old spirituality, but we need a new vehicle to express it in the modern world.
Because our explanations and our understanding of the universe has changed. And if you want to cripple humanity, you create, you keep them in fundamentalism. You keep them in saying, no, you can't change. You can't think outside of that box. Well, that goes absolutely counter to our entheogenic experience.
So how is your priesthood of Nefertum going then, as a
Well,
modern religion?
I'm still trying to get the word out. It's been just a handful of us in the early stages, and we're, first and foremost, we've got to try to go rescue this flower. The flower is going extinct, so now I have a crowdfunding campaign to try to get us over to Egypt and get the people over there to farm us some blue lotus, which is going to be an interesting proposition. I don't want to tell them that they're here, grow this because it is psychotropic. The Muslim state is not going to like that. So I've got to be very careful about how do I convince the people of Egypt to save this sacred flower.
So is it just climate change? Is that why it's endangered, or what's the deal?
No, it's pollution actually is the big thing, is that it used to grow in the Nile, and of course the Nile used to flood, but they built the dams in order to produce the power, and so now the Nile doesn't flood, and then they didn't, one thing led to another, and then they had to use fertilizers, and all the fertilizers are now flowing into the Nile, and then so you've got chemical imbalance and terrible pollution within the Nile. So essentially, the flower has died outside of just private ponds. So here's this most sacred flower, a flower that literally had a god inside of it that is just dying. So
That's so symbolic of the old world and the
it
new world,
is
isn't it?
very symbolic. So,
So tell us, what's the crowdfunding link then? How can people help support that?
yeah, I'm just going to give you the sacredfoundation.org link. You can reach it there. You can also reach it through the sacredbluelotus.com website. It's on Causevox. I believe it is. Let me see if I can get this right. I'm doing it off the top of my head. It is Blue Lotus Rescue. Dot Causevox.
Okay, well, I'll put that in the links in the episode. And are you also leading a an expedition to Egypt, a tour
I
group?
am in March of next year, March 1st through the 14th, 15th. Group of us are going to Egypt, both as part of this rescue project, so we can get some people on the ground there to be able to start both discover where the ponds are that still have the flowers in them. We do know that there are still some growing. We just need to find exactly who has those. So we've got to get on the ground, and then because of the interest around this, then it was suggested that I co-facilitate a tour. So we've set up a Blue Lotus specific tour of the ancient temples. And that is March 1st through the 15th of 2019.
Beautiful. All right. Well, I encourage everyone who's got an interest in the Blue Lotus and these mystery traditions to join you on that.
Thank you.
Awesome. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Arista. Thank you so much
It's
for your wisdom.
been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Rick.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's keep that mystery sacred out there, and let's see what we can do as more people want to join this movement and have their own relationship with that mystery. I think that there'll be more structure and more of these containers, whether we call them churches or religions or working groups or whatever, but it seems like the future is the group consciousness.
I believe so.
Yeah. All right. Many blessings.
Thank you. Blessings to you.
Aloha.
Bye.